this is my weekly podcast, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, a show dedicated to sharing stories and spreading awareness about maternal mood disorders. For show notes and more information, please go to my website, ppdadventures.com. There's also a Facebook page, facebook.com/ppdadventures. And now, on to the show. Hello, everyone. This is episode 38, and after a bunch of episodes with just me, or actually, it wasn't a bunch of episodes. There was a mini hiatus as I took some me time, and then there were a couple episodes with me. But anyway, we're back to interviews. Today, we have a wonderful interview with Beth talking about the birth of her first child, where she had a post-traumatic stress disorder, and then the birth of her second child, where she had anxiety and depression. And it took a long time for her to get diagnosed. But before we get to Beth, I want to talk to you for a little bit. Quick weaning report. I was very gentle with myself again last week with the Zoloft and got myself back to a good place. So this week, I am doing every other day 75 milligrams Zoloft and every other day 50 milligrams. Slow and steady. It's not a race. And you know, I'm being very transparent with you guys about my Zoloft weaning because I trust you. You can handle this. My story, not your story. My body chemistry, not your body chemistry. You have to work with yourself and your psychiatrist and your team to figure out your process, your journey, whether you need meds, whether it's time to wean, how you're going to wean. But I love sharing the slowness of my weaning process because I mean, I look at some stuff online and it's like some people, I mean, like it's like 1 week you're on 100, the next week 75, boom, 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 you're done. Or, I mean, it's just like a weaning over the course of a few days. So maybe I'm planting a seed in people's heads that it doesn't have to be a 3 day journey or even 3 weeks, that you are allowed to do this as slowly as you need to. But I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a doctor of any sorts, I'm not a medical health professional of any sorts, I'm not even an armchair therapist. I'm a podcaster, I'm a woman, I'm a person, I am a storyteller, and I believe in the power of stories, and I believe that we as women have so many experiences and some that are so common and universal, or maybe not per se universal, but like they're not abnormal, and yet we're not encouraged to share those stories so they can feel abnormal because you can feel like I'm the only woman suffering from this and I don't have a way to talk to friends. Whereas if we just pooled all our knowledge together, I feel like we'd be so much better off. And maybe in the past or maybe in the present, but in different societies and places of the world other than my place here in Southern California, maybe women are getting that, but I feel like I didn't, and I feel like a lot, the more and more I talk to women and friends about this, the more it feels like our stories have been silenced, and there's an oral history that's being lost, and I think it's really important for us to share our stories. So that's what I'm here for. I'm not your counselor, not your psychiatrist, but I trust you totally. You've got this. Okay, so before we get to Beth, I want to talk about Richard Simmons. Probably a weird topic for a postpartum depression podcast. Yeah, no, there's no probably about it. It is. If you had asked me last June when I was starting this show, are we going to ever talk about Richard Simmons? I would have been like, what the fuck are you talking about? Why would we talk about Richard Simmons? But I just finished listening to the last episode of the podcast Missing Richard Simmons. I've been binging on it for the past few days. And it's just a 6-episode show. And I just followed them on Facebook to, you know, in case they ever come out with an update. But I had no idea that Richard Simmons disappeared. That, because he's just such a public persona. And they refer to how he's like been sort of turned into that go-to easy Halloween costume. But I just, you know, he's just such a huge public persona. I had no idea that he'd left because he's just made so many Letterman appearances that, you know, and just all the talk shows and all the, we owned Sweat Into the Oldies when I was a kid. And that was like the first way I learned how to exercise. and I loved it as like a 12-year-old, and I bought it again just for the nostalgia. And you know, now I talk about it, I kind of want to like stop recording and go home and do Sweat Into the Oldies. And yes, I'd have to go home because I usually do my podcast interviews at my parents' house so that you don't hear children screaming for me in the background. Because if I'm gone, they're totally fine. They love their daddy. They're obsessed with daddy, or their babysitter they love, my parents they love. If they're with anyone but me, they're totally fine. But if I'm there, they have to have me. And so there's no like, oh, mommy's here, but mommy's going to the other room for an hour. We're going to respect that time. Like, no. And you know, sometimes I get really worked up about that, but I just remember this phase is so brief, and I'm going to blink my eyes and they're going to be these surly, smelly, moody teenagers, and I'm going to be like desperately like knocking on the door and like, let me in, give me like 2 minutes of your attention, because I know I was constantly closing the door and listening to my albums, and it was so important to have that alone time and to be on the phone talking to my friends even though I'd spent all day at school with them. So this is just a phase, and I don't even need to tolerate it. I need to relish it. And I've been doing more of that the past few days and letting go and just thinking, like, I'm not treading water. I'm just enjoying this because this is going to pass too quickly. And, you know, and this past week, I made a point of the first half of the week, I was kind of in a tough place because of Zoloft withdrawal symptoms. I talked about that last week. And then I just kind of let go. And when Pippa said, I want you to play house and I want you to come behind the couch and crouch in this weird position and pretend you're daddy and I'm mommy, I just went with it. And I got there and I pretended it was nighttime and lay there on like the cold marble, like in front of our fireplace, and just let go. And it was really fun to just like leave the phone in the kitchen for hours on end and go outside with the kids and play whatever makeup game Pippa wanted to do, or play catch as long as they wanted to catch. But anyway, Richard Simmons. So Richard Simmons used to have this studio called Slimmons, and I knew about it because he actually taught a weekly class at his Beverly Hills studio, and I remember hearing about it like 10 years ago and how people would dress up and anyone could go to like this $12 class and be in the same room exercising with Richard Simmons. And I wanted to go. And I was too afraid. This was before I had kids, when I lived on the West Side. I was like, I came up with excuses and I was just too shy to do it. I was like, I don't own enough fancy clothes to dress up enough. I just can't do this. I don't deserve this. I haven't earned the right to be in the room as Richard Simmons. This is like, it's just, and I can look back now, I'm like, just so stupid. But I always thought, well, I can always do this at some later time. Next week, next month, next year. But the Slimmons studio got closed down, and it was 3 years ago that Richard just stopped showing up for his regular class, the weekly class he had been teaching for like 40 years. And so it's gone. He hasn't been seen in public in 3 years. And this podcast is done by someone, a producer who used to work on The Daily Show. So someone, you know, legit, not someone like, you know. Well, no, I don't want to call myself illegit. I'm legit. I've got my microphone. I've got you guys. And what I'm doing here is legit. But, you know, someone with a lot more experience than me. And he was, like, trying to track down information and interviewing all the people who were close to Richard to find out what the hell happened. Because he went from being this really big public presence to completely withdrawing and cutting off all of the people he was in contact with. And so one thing that was going through my mind was like, wow, I missed out on this. I could have gone 3.5 years ago, or, you know, any other time since I first learned about his class, I could have been there and had that experience and had that memory to share with you. And I can't now. It's done. He closed the studio, and I have to assume he's not coming back. And that has just fired me up to make more of a list of all the things I want to do and be proactive about it and not be assumed like I can do this in 5 years or 10. I don't want to live that way. And just things that seem stupid, like I really want to go roller skating. So I just need to make that happen. Like, shit, folks, like, let's not let spring end without Courtney roller skating. All right. Can we do that? Can we hold me to that? But then on another level, I was thinking about, they talk in a lot of the episodes, and by the way, if I haven't said this, I loved this podcast, and I totally recommend it to any of you podcast junkies out there looking for like your next podcast hit. And it was refreshing to have a show that was like as engaging as that first season of Serial, but without it being like about a murder. So anyway, Richard, it became clear listening to the show that he had a ton of relationships with people who he met through his work and who he called like every week, or who he saw at his studio every week, and people who felt like they really were connected to Richard. But then he would go on these talk shows and the hosts would ask him about his personal life, and he would say, "I have none. I go to my studio, I dance with people, I take a couple hundred photographs, I go home, and that's it. That's my life." And they interviewed a celebrity bus tour driver on the show, and apparently, you know, these celebrity buses just drive around trying to get celebrity sightings for LA tourists. And Richard Simmons was like, used to be this really reliable stop, because he would like, if he was home and he saw the tour bus, he'd come running out and he would shake hands and take photos and talk to all the people on the bus. And so like this one bus driver's like said he must have met Richard like 200 times. But there's like 40 other bus drivers who would say the same thing. So just think about that. Think how like Richard made this part of his life. And yet he says he had no life beyond this public persona. And that to me made me think about something, and I haven't fully thought it through, but let me try. I don't want this podcast. I want to keep doing this podcast. Don't get worried. I'm not leaving, but I don't want this podcast to become a substitute for me having and cultivating real-time relationships with people. So I'm not suggesting I'm ever going to be like Richard Simmons. I think we can all agree on that. But what I'm saying is that doing these interviews is so enjoyable, and I always feel so like, it's like I'm talking about these depressing things, but I always feel energized afterwards because I love how I'm having these real meaningful conversations with women who have lived through experiences that totally, well, like I can totally understand and they can understand what's happened to me. But I don't want these one-off interviews, and sometimes, and hopefully I'll get to do follow-up interviews, but I don't want interviews to become a substitute for actual intimacy. Don't mean sexual intimacy here, folks, because there's intimacy on different, you can experience it in different ways, and you don't have to just limit it to like that one relationship, and I don't think you should. Oh, I hate to talk in shoulds, but you know what I mean. And I don't want to let this podcast become my crutch or my excuse to not engage with people, because I've always, or not always, but I've had a history of being, of shyness. I've had a history of holding back and not letting people see the cracks in my life or my fears, not sticking to a tougher exterior, a sarcastic, dark humor, straight A exterior, like an armor. I don't want this podcast. I want this podcast to be another tool in me shedding my armor. I don't want it to accidentally become a new piece of armor. Does that make sense? And I don't want me running a support group. That's something I really like doing, and it brings a lot of meaning to my life. But I don't want to neglect the friendships I have, and the friendships that are slowly growing. I don't want those to. I don't want the support group to replace those, and I don't want actual friendships to replace the support group. So it's just something that's on my mind, and I like being honest here because then I'm being honest with myself. That as important as this podcast is to me, I don't want it to become my life, because at the end of the day, it's just a microphone and the person I'm talking to is not here with me. And I love the connections I'm making and the friendships I'm forming, because there are, you know, there's a lot of us out there who are fired up advocates, but there aren't enough yet. And we have to find each other. This is my way of finding my, the people who share my passion. So I love that. But I don't want it to become an excuse for me retreating from the other aspects of my life, like Pippa's preschool. She's been there now almost 2 years, and I'm getting to know a lot of moms really well. And I would like to continue investing the time in those friendships and not retreat from real honesty and real friendships just because I have real honesty and real friendships here. Now I'm just blathering. All right, so that's enough of me and Richard Simmons. I'm going to turn this over to Beth now, and I'll see you on the flip side. Sorry, haha, it's me again. Just kidding on us starting the Beth interview. I forgot. I actually wanted to give a trigger warning. I don't usually give trigger warnings because the name of the show is postpartum, I don't even know the name of my own show. The name of the show, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, is trigger warning enough. But that said, Beth this week talks about her son, who is 10 months old and who has a very rare genetic disorder that affects his adrenal glands. And that could be a trigger for some of you, in which case I think maybe skip this episode, but listen to like the last 5 minutes, because the last 5 minutes, Beth is talking about some stuff that's like very inspirational, but without touching on that trigger for you. So, you know, if this is a trigger for you, you know it's a trigger for you. If not, go ahead and enjoy the show. Thank you. Hi, Beth. Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I know a bit about your story of postpartum depression and anxiety, and I know you have 2 kids, so why don't we start with your first child? How old's your first?
She is 5 and a half, and she's very quick to tell you she's 5 and a half.
Yes.
She's going into kindergarten, and, you know, this coming school year, so.
And did you have any maternal mood disorders with her?
I don't think I did. I mean, I had some anxiety, but I feel like in my small group of mommy friends, it was very normal. The anxiety I had, I looked around and I saw it in a lot of other mothers. So I didn't really think of that as a maternal mood disorder. I will say that I was, when she was a baby, I had a lot of anger. And unfortunately, I think that was projected onto my husband because, like, he did everything wrong, or he just couldn't do it like me or anything like that. And I didn't really know much about maternal mood disorders back then. So, I definitely didn't suffer like I suffered this time. But I did experience a birth trauma with my daughter. I hemorrhaged a lot after her birth, and it was not handled properly. I actually had her at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I bled all day. I mean, they didn't even call my doctor, the nurses. And, my doctor finally showed up at like 11 o'clock at night, and she was pissed, and she made no bones about it. I mean, she let them know she was pissed. I had to go to have an emergency DNC, because my uterus just wouldn't contract. It was so full of blood. And then I sat in the hospital, and so that was a Sunday. Sat in the hospital till Tuesday, and Tuesday they finally decided to give me a blood transfusion. So I was just really sick and traumatized after having her, and I probably should have just run to therapy at that point, but I didn't. I was kind of busy at that point, and I was very sick. I was so anemic and vitamin D deficient, just everything after I had her. But it was very traumatizing, and I remember my one-year checkup after her being in my doctor's office crying. Like, that's not normal to be crying a year after something has happened. Or, you know, I should have been in therapy at that point. But it was very traumatic, and I felt like my hemorrhaging might have had something to do with having an epidural. I actually wound up having 2 epidurals because my first one, I wiggled it out. I remember just moving a lot, my body needing to move a lot. And so with my second child, I really wanted a natural childbirth. I felt like I could have done it naturally with my daughter, but I just wasn't prepared. So the second time around, I hired a doula, which was an amazing experience. They are basically your advocate in the hospital. And she was there to remind me of my rights as a patient. But yeah, I don't think I really had postpartum mood disorder as much as I had like some PTSD from the birth of my daughter. I acted like my desire to have a natural childbirth with my second was not out of a place of wanting to feel empowered or anything like that. It was more a fear. And, yeah, so.
Well, PTSD, don't belittle PTSD. That's part of the whole family. Like, whenever I'm listing off mood disorders, I always forget to include it, but PTSD should be up there, right, with depression and anxiety, and that's definitely, I mean, I'm just feeling, you keep saying, like, it was, you know, traumatizing, and I'm feeling the trauma for you, just like,
yeah,
I can't believe you were hemorrhaging for that long before they even told your doctor.
Oh, yeah, it was pretty bad, and it was almost like there had to be a shift change in the hospital, because if you think about it, it's like 7 p.m. is like the shift change, and my doctor showed up at 11. So there was like this shift change, and I got this nurse that like completely flipped the script. She walked in, and she took charge, and she was like, what is going on? I remember hearing her say, has anybody called her doctor? And then at that point, things started moving. So, yeah, it was... It was crazy. And, like, I was very traumatized. And with my second child, I had the birth that I wanted. I had a natural childbirth. It was so beautiful. It was just amazing. It was a great experience. But afterwards, I was terrified of hemorrhaging again. And I would call the nurse. Like, if I had to go to the bathroom to pee, I would call the nurse. I would make her come in the room, go in the bathroom with me, and make sure that I was bleeding the proper amount. I mean, I was so terrified of hemorrhaging again. And of course my doctor put some things into place to try to prevent that. Like there's medications, if you have a history of hemorrhaging, there's medications that they can offer you to try to prevent that from happening. Because if you've hemorrhaged once, you have a risk of hemorrhaging again. So I had the nurse come in. I know she was frustrated with me, but I didn't care at that point. I just wanted somebody to make sure constantly that I was okay.
And you know, you mentioned something I wanted to ask you about, that you had the epidurals with your first and you thought those caused the hemorrhaging. Was that something that you thought like your doctor told you or you read about, or was that just like a link that you came up with in your mind?
I think there's no way my doctor would have told me that, because, you know, I think that would be like a liability for a doctor to say that, like, it's something so common as an epidural to cause it. But what happened is my uterus, like, had a hard time contracting. And I have a history of being really sensitive to anesthesia. Like, it takes a long time for me to come out of it, and I get weepy and all kinds of crazy things. And I remember my epidural when I had her was so strong, I couldn't even tell I was pushing. I was asking them, am I pushing? You know, because it had numbed me so much. I read some things that, you know, maybe an epidural can increase your chances of hemorrhaging, but I don't think any doctor is probably going to tell their patient that. So she definitely didn't. She's very matter of fact. So most likely it was something that I, like, basically, if I had read it, I was going to try to, if I heard something, I was going to follow it. I just wanted to try everything I possibly could, because I felt like this was a chance, it was almost a chance of redemption. Like, I remember that even when I was having him, I just remember thinking, this is my chance to have a positive experience. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't want to go to my one-year checkup and cry like I did with her.
And when was your second child born?
He was born in June.
Okay.
This past June, and it was beautiful. Like, I remember it was 8 o'clock at night. My doula, I, like, mostly labored the stuff is silly, but it was super effective. I was there for 2 hours, not even, pushed for 11 minutes. I mean, but I labored on the toilet. So I guess when I was in the bathroom, She put Christmas lights all over the room, and it was 8 o'clock at night, and the sun was setting, and I look out of our window, and there's this beautiful pink sky, and it was literally like you couldn't have had a better. My nurse had been a doula in the past,
mm-hmm.
so everybody was just like working together really naturally, and oh, it was just wonderful. But yeah, I had him in June.
Okay, so he's now
8 months.
10 months. Gosh, my math.
Yeah, I know. This is like, oh, trust me, I had a hard time this week. He turned 10 months old, and it was very, I cried.
I think I'm going to cry when Julian next month turns 18 months, because then I kind of feel like I'm done with counting the months.
Yep.
And he's my last. It's like, okay, this is it.
Yep. Yeah, you'll start counting years instead of months, but mm-hmm. you're exactly right.
So how did you feel, how was that journey after your second birth? So it was ideal, but it turned into, from what I know, like a bit of a nightmare for you.
Well, so apparently we have conflicting blood types. So he had to deal with some jaundice issues. I was not sleeping well in the hospital, so I pretty much told the doctor, I was like, you do whatever you need to do to get us out of here because I cannot sleep. We had, somebody had hit, somebody had hit something on the road and the hospital lost power one night. We were sitting there in like 80 some degree, almost 90 degree temperatures in the dark. They had like a generator, but it was only one plug in each room. It was awful. So anyway, we survived, but, we got home. He had the little glowworm blankets for his jaundice, and we were like, okay, this is temporary. We'll be fine. And then we go to his checkup, and he lost like a huge amount of weight, which was, I kind of suspected because he was super swollen when he was born. He had a lot of water retention. But anyways, then we were like, okay, we'll deal with that. He'll gain weight once he starts eating. And then like a week after he was born, we get this odd phone call from the doctor. So odd that I'm not even sure he knew what was exactly going on. But he said it was a Friday evening. So he said, you need to go to the children's hospital because something in his newborn screening didn't come back, like it came back off the charts, and we want to get it rechecked. And normally you could come into the office, but because it's like 5 o'clock on a Friday, you have to go to the ER. And we thought we were just going to like he said, I'm going to call ahead. I don't know what happened, but we wound up being admitted. I mean, you know, I got a week old baby, I got a 5 year old at home. Thankfully we live on the same street as my parents, so they're really helpful, but we drop everything. We're in 5 o'clock rush hour traffic. We have no idea what's going on. So we get there and they put a Heplock in his little hand. We get admitted into the emergency room. I thought we were just going in there for blood work and like floating out, but we didn't. We were there for like 3 hours. At this point, I'm nursing. I'm still postpartum. I have nothing I need. We're starving. We're thirsty. We haven't had dinner. So they come back and they say, okay, well, his electrolytes are good. And he came back as possibly having this genetic condition called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. It's very rare, but we just want to test him because his numbers were off the chart, but we want to test to see what his numbers actually are because the newborn screening only, you know, there's a range that mm-hmm. I test for. Well, his were off the charts, so they did another test. The problem with these tests is they take like a week to come back. This is not an immediate thing. So long story short, we keep getting these phone calls to like go to the hospital. Like the test would come back and then we would have to go to the hospital. And we're looking at him and he looks fine to us. He was a little lethargic, but he ate well and he slept a lot. But long story short, he does have this condition. It's very rare. Thankfully, we live near Children's Hospital. He has an endocrinologist there. The thing about it is it affects his adrenal glands, which affects pretty much everything. He doesn't have the ability to produce cortisol normally, so we have to give him, like a hydrocortisone steroid. And it's like this balancing act, because if he gets too much, it stunts his growth, but if he doesn't get enough, he can go into like an adrenal crisis, or he could like go into puberty early. And then when I say early, I mean like 5 years old or something crazy, which would stunt his growth. You know, he'll be shorter. But it also affects his ability if he's really sick, like vomiting, or if he has a high fever. We can wind up in the emergency room. It's deadly at that point. So there's a lot of, like, with this condition, it's not black and white. There's a lot of, like, having to make these judgment calls. But that's pretty much when the anxiety started. Is when you have a sick kid and there's no clear definition of what you're supposed to do, I started becoming extremely paranoid about his fever, because if he has a fever, we might have to give him injections or give him more medicine or whatever. But I also remember those first few months just never being able to look at my son and see him. It was always like I saw his condition. I just saw this sick baby, even though he was not sick, but like every cry was a possible catastrophe. Every time he made a noise, I remember one time he started screaming and I shot up out of my chair. I pushed my husband out of the way, who was like 6'2", 200 and some pounds. I mean, I don't even think my feet touched the ground. I flew, and you know, nothing was wrong, but you know, having a sick child, every cry, you know, is a possible problem. And my husband, I think, had the ability to look at him as a baby and just see him. But with his medications, I still do. He has to take a steroid 3 times a day. And then back then, because this is a condition that can affect his electrolyte, you know, his salt level and stuff, we had to add salt water to his bottle. So, like, every time I'm, adding salt to his bottle or giving him medicine, it was just a constant reminder that something was wrong. And I knew my anxiety was high, but I said, of course it's high. You have a sick kid. Of course, you right. know? Still didn't go to therapy at that point. There's another incident where I should have just gone straight to therapy.
Well, don't beat yourself up about that. I mean, how many? I think everyone has something in their life where it's like, should have gone to therapy, didn't.
Yeah.
Don't ever beat yourself up.
My therapist is literally, we live in front of a tree farm, and she is across the tree farm. Like, I could literally run to therapy. but I didn't. And like you said, I've learned to forgive myself for that, because I have this mentality of pushing through things. That's just what I've always done. Self-care is kind of a new term for me.
Well, I think I would have, in your circumstances, like, yeah, I have a sick baby. I would have totally justified the anxiety.
Yeah, which now I know that only increases your risk of having postpartum mood disorders.
Of course.
So at that point, everything's fine. Other than, like I said, just some heightened anxiety, but I'm sleeping well. Everything's going fine. And then my husband loses his job, which is probably my worst fear ever. So I start to panic. I literally am panicking over, you know, I have a sick kid. We're about to lose our health insurance. It's at the end of the year, so we don't qualify for any type of assistance with insurance because, you know, he had already made enough money for the year. You know, we didn't qualify for any help. So here we are. He's the only income. He's unemployed. We have a kid that needs to, like, at that point, he's going to the endocrinologist, a specialist, twice a month. And, you know, I started having these neck pains that I thought were an ear infection. Went to the doctor. She didn't see anything wrong. But she was like, I'm going to give you an antibiotic. Oh, and I'm going to put you on prednisone just in case. I don't even know why she put me on prednisone, but she did. And I wound up having the worst panic attack I've ever had. And it actually sent me to the emergency room. and they did CAT scans and all kinds of stuff. And they said, you know, you're okay, you're not dying, and they sent me home. Well, a few days later, I wound up having, like, I started getting really dizzy. My blood pressure was kind of high because I have a blood pressure cuff, which is the last thing you should have when you have anxiety. You should not have a blood pressure cuff in your house. But my blood pressure was super high. And I had this weird thing that had never happened to me before. My mouth and my throat went so dry, I could not even swallow food. So we went back to the emergency room. And at this point, the nurse was a little concerned. But the doctor looked at me and said, you need to go to your doctor. And he gave me a few Ativans, but he said, you need to go to your doctor. And at that point, I was seeing, like, just a physician. I didn't even go to my OB at that point because I still, to this point, have no idea I'm suffering from a postpartum problem. Because at this point, my symptoms are so physical, I think I'm dying. So I go to my doctor, and she just basically says, I can't do anything for you. You need to go to your OB. So I go to my OB, who I have a great relationship with. I'm very close with her. It took me a little while to have my second kid, so I was in and out of her office quite a bit. But the nurse, who I was also kind of close with, she would ask me questions like, am I attached to my child? I'm like, yeah, maybe a little too attached. She would ask me questions like, do I want to hurt myself or hurt others? And I was like, of course not. Those were like, that was where it ended. You know, she should have asked, do you feel like you're dying all the time? have you been to the emergency room a lot? Yes. So the questions did not fit. Like, they fit the depression side, which I didn't have at that point. But there was no questions asked that screened for, like, OCD, the harming yourself, but anxiety. There were no questions over anxiety, panic attacks, anything like that. So I go there, and at this point, I am getting progressively worse. Like, I'm starting to not be able to sleep very well. So I go to my doctor. She puts me on, like, a very minuscule dose of Buspar. It's not working. I start panicking. I'm calling her, and she's like, you know, I can't do anything for you. I can't do anything else for you. You need to go see a psychiatrist. And I go to a psychiatrist, and he just basically puts me on this. And he doesn't even talk to me about postpartum mood disorders. This guy graduated from the Mayo Clinic. He is highly educated. And he puts me on a regimen of, like, Ativan and temazepam at night, which is just like another benzo to help you sleep. And at first it helps a little bit, and it calmed my anxiety. But when the anxiety started going away, I realized that I was depressed. So I started getting really sad. I'd cry all the time. So temazepam would put me in a state of relaxation sometimes at night, but it didn't actually allow me. I was sleeping, like, at this point, 3 hours a night. And at this point, I had crazy physical symptoms. I had my heart racing. I'd wake up with my heart racing. My throat would get incredibly dry. Sometimes I would feel these, like, vibrations in my head. Like, I guess it was just anxiety. And trying to think, oh, I would throw up. I would literally wake up in the middle of the night, throw up, and go lay back down, just out of nowhere. I started not being able to eat, which is so rare for me. Usually when I'm stressed, I can, like, eat. Uh-huh. So, but I started not being able to eat, and that was super scary. I'll just fast forward.
And like, the couldn't eat was, like, a physical, like you were talking earlier, physical. About the dry throat. Like, it's not like a lack of interest.
No, it was physical. I literally couldn't stomach food. There were certain foods that I would try to eat, and I would immediately, like, start gagging and throw up. And I literally, it was the craziest thing that's ever happened to me. Like, my postpartum was so physical. I actually, like, I went to an integrative health specialist. I was in the cancer department of our local university hospital with an endocrinologist that looked at me and said, something is wrong with you, and I'm going to find out. She did every test on my thyroid. She did every test on everything, and everything came back normal. Like, I had a professor at a medical school think that I was, like, something was seriously wrong with me. Like, nobody at this point really, and I had even seen a psychiatrist, like, nobody talked to me about postpartum issues. And I will say that, like, the psychiatrist, he diagnosed me with generalized anxiety disorder, and then he diagnosed me with panic disorder. And I reflect back on this because I think he knows that I was, like, at this point I was 4 months postpartum. And that's another thing, you know, people think that postpartum issues happen the first 6 weeks, but mine didn't really start until the fourth month. So anyways, my psychiatrist, I have mixed feelings about him because I was resistant to taking an antidepressant. I was resistant. I was scared. And I wonder if he looked at me and said, this woman has postpartum issues, but I'm not going to bother talking to her about it. It really doesn't, I don't know if he maybe thought, oh, it doesn't really matter. But it matters to me. Like, when you diagnose me with generalized anxiety disorder, I feel like that's a condition that I'm going to have for the rest of my life. Whereas if he said, listen, you're having postpartum anxiety and some OCD, I might have felt like less of a life sentence at this point.
Well, I'm just angry for you because he either got the diagnosis wrong or had it right and didn't tell you, and they have no right to do that.
Well, I feel like because there were times he was kind of rude, and I remember because my mom would come with me, because at this point, I can't even be alone with my kids. I'm having panic attacks. I'm so scared. I just have this, like, fear all the time because I think, oh, my gosh, I haven't slept all night. I can't care for my kids. Like, thankfully, I have family that were, like, they were literally with me around the clock. I was so bad, but he was kind of rude. And like I said, I have mixed feelings about him because I have a friend who he's part of her team. Like, she was hospitalized for postpartum issues, and he has really helped her. Now, I don't think he was, like, the first doctor she saw, but he's her current doctor. He's helping somebody. But he wasn't helping me.
Right.
And he was very short with me. And I felt like I was bothering him, you know. But anyways, so at this point, I'm super sick. Like, I am throwing up. I've lost a lot of weight. My hair's falling out. I can't be alone with my kids. I'm terrified. And it's really affecting my daughter. Like, she's starting to not be able to be alone. She's getting scared. She won't play in a room by herself. You know, she's very, you know, much understanding something's going wrong. And at this point, this is like November. So we're like Christmas time, you know, baby's first Christmas is awful. I made sure I took pictures, but I'll probably look back on the picture. I probably won't even look at the pictures, honestly. But this was all, and like I said, I've been to several specialists and this, that, and the other. But I finally, so we are in an area with a medical school. And I get this number for this woman. And this is all this is all happening quite fast. There's a woman who is in the Department of Medicine at this university. She's a psychiatrist. She runs a women's clinic out of this medical school. She's one of the leading, she might actually be the only psychiatrist in my state that specializes in women's issues. So he runs this, like I said, this women's clinic for postpartum issues. I don't know why I didn't know any of this. It's a 20-minute drive from my house. So I finally go to her, which is a miracle, because I'm not sitting in front of one of her residents. I am literally sitting in front of her. I emailed her personally. She, you know, it takes months to see her. I was in her office within days of emailing her. And had a completely different psychiatry experience. She saw me as a person. We talked about her dog, because I had mentioned something about working with animals. And I'm just sitting here thinking, like, this is a psychiatrist. She's so personable. I've never met, like, rarely are, I hate to say this, but rarely are any doctors this personable. She was so friendly, and she looked me square in the eye and said, "You have postpartum depression, and you're going to get better. And this is just temporary." And nobody had looked at me and said that until just then. The other psychiatrist, like I said, I just felt like I had a life sentence. He would never answer questions directly. You know, he would just like talk to the point where I didn't even understand what he was saying. He was so, I wonder if he was just scared to be direct. But this woman would answer all my questions. She asked about my children. She just seemed to have a personal interest in me. And like I said, she looked at me and said, "You're going to get better." And the thing that she did after that that just made me want to follow her with reckless abandonment is she picked up on the fact that I was a person of faith, and she prayed with me at the end of our meeting. She prayed with me. And that was just the most amazing experience. Like I said, I was really scared to take any type of medication. And I was really, really scared. It probably took more courage to take medication than it took to have a natural childbirth for me. I would probably have done natural childbirth 10 more times than taken medication if I could have. We came up with a plan at the doctor's appointment that day, and she was like, "And you're going to email me, you're going to do this, and then you're going to email me in the morning." And so I did what she told me to do. I emailed her in the morning, and she emailed me back saying, "Okay, this sounds like it's working. Let's do this again. Email me in the morning." And for like a month, we literally emailed back and forth every day. I mean, this woman just really... Like I said, I followed her with reckless abandonment after that, because she just really cared, and I just really trusted her. But, sorry, I told you I'd go on a tangent. And that was...
That's not a tangent at all, and you made me cry. I've never heard of a doctor praying with their patient, and I'm just so happy that you found this psychiatrist who helped you so much.
She's just amazing. I actually emailed her this week, and I said, "I'm being interviewed for a podcast." She just said, "Bless your heart," or "Bless you," you know. I mean, we email back and forth to this day. She just is super available to me. And she might even email me and say, "Okay, sounds like you need to come in. Can you come in tomorrow?" Like, she's a professor, but she will come into her office just to see me that day. Like, that just makes me... Like, I remember one time, because we've had a few meetings, because we've slowly adjusted medication and figured out things that work for me, and there was a time where I was getting better, but the medication, we weren't hitting the right medication, and we both knew it. And I said, "I just want to thank you for coming in and meeting with me." And she looked me, like I said, she always looks me dead in the eye and says things like this, but she looked me dead in the eye and she said, "You are worth this. You are worth every bit of this." And she's just awesome. But I think that one of the keys to getting better with this condition is finding a doctor you can trust. Because when your anxiety is so high, rest assured, you're going to have some side effects of the medication. Maybe not always, but when you first start, it's going to make you, I don't know, like, I feel like there was a little bit of an overshoot when I started taking medicine. And, like, just having her email saying, okay, this, I'm feeling a little jittery, I'm feeling this and that and that. You know, just being able to email her and then her, like, coming back to me saying, this is common, keep going. Like, she would literally say, keep going, hang in there, stuff like that. It was just so helpful because if I didn't have her doing that, I might have, like, just stopped, just quit. And that, I probably would have wound up in the hospital.
I'm just so happy to hear that there's doctors like this, because
my
psychiatrist could have learned a few things from her.
Well, my first one probably could have learned a few things as well.
Yes.
But, she's great.
So, did you guys eventually hit on the right cocktail for you?
I think so. I am on Paxil, which is, I think, at first, I had to be put on a mood stabilizer, which is like the nice way of saying antipsychotic. Mm-hmm. But, I had to be put on a very low dose because a lot of, like, I think it was Seroquel, that medication in a low dose can actually really help with anxiety. And it did, but then I started having problems with, like, I was severely depressed, could barely get out of bed, you know, things like that. And that's when we kind of started. So I needed kind of like to be stabilized first because I got really bad. Like I couldn't stop moving. I couldn't sleep. My heart was racing all the time. I thought I was literally going to keel over and die. And I would be alone with my kids and my kids would just be walking around the house. You know, I had all these, like I had some OCD. One of my intrusive thoughts was, you're going to go crazy. You're going to go into psychosis and you're going to be alone with your kids and you can't do that. So I had to be stabilized first. And I say, the reason I say that, but I just feel like I need to say, I was on an antipsychotic because there's a lot of mothers out there that are going to be pushed something like that. And then they're going to go online, which you don't need to do. Don't go online. Because your anxiety is already so high, just do what your doctor tells you. And if it doesn't work, then it doesn't work, and you just try something else. And that's kind of what we did. The anxiety started getting a little bit better, but I was extremely depressed still, and I couldn't do the things I needed to do on a day-to-day basis. So that's when we started Paxil, which has helped me a lot. I'm actually really new to this still. I'm only in my 8th week of Paxil. Like, it really took me a long time to find the right doctors and the right medication. So I'm still, you know, they say it takes a long while for the medicine to fully kick in, and I'm still there. Like, I'm in my 8th week of surprisingly a fairly low dose of Paxil, and I do take 15 milligrams of Remeron at night to sleep, to help me sleep.
That's my baby.
Yeah, so that's your jam, huh?
I hate that it's that we all have, so that it's not one size fits all.
Yeah,
and that just makes
it
so much harder on us because we're dealing with motherhood, which is just such a big, you know, it's just tough even without a mood disorder thrown in, and then that you had to have such a long journey to actually get the freaking diagnosis.
Yeah.
When it's so obvious. You're 4 months postpartum, your son is dealing with a very rare genetic disorder, you had PTSD from your first time, any doctor should have, like, figured it out really quickly.
Yeah, they should have, but I feel like unless you're depressed, my experience was, and my mother keeps saying this too, because she went to a lot of the doctor's appointments with me. It was like, do you want to hurt yourself? Do you want to hurt others? Do you feel attached to your baby? They kept asking me things like that. they never asked me anything that would have red flagged me for anxiety, other than I was having like crazy physical symptoms and I thought I was dying and I was in the ER. Like, and my husband had lost his job. So a lot of times they thought, oh, she's just having a hard time. Well, that increases my chances even further now. I know now. So, but my doctor is amazing. And I also see a counselor and she's amazing also. I feel like whether you choose medication or not, I didn't choose medication. It was like a necessity. But whether you take medication or not, therapy to me is not an option. You should be in therapy if this is something you're going through. That's just my humble opinion. But therapy is, I think, something that every woman with a postpartum mood disorder should at least get into.
I agree with you on that, and there are professionals who agree with you.
Good.
I've been reading Dr. Shoshana Bennett, one of her books, and she keeps hammering in, you need therapy.
I feel like parents, like, instead of going to labor and delivery classes where it's complete crap, like, those classes are complete crap. They give you such a skewed view of what your hospital experience is going to be like. You should just take that money and go to therapy instead. Like, just go ahead and do it. It'll make you a better parent. It might wreck you at first, but that's good, you know.
Yeah, the body, the heart, the soul is all made to heal. So you can wreck it, and then you can repair it even better than ever.
Yeah, for sure.
So how do you feel like you're doing these days?
I still have, let me start with the postpartum periods. I've never had issues like with mood during or before my period. But I've been doing really well, and then I will start the placebos of my birth control because I have some hormonal issues, and birth control is supposed to, I have PCOS, and birth control is supposed to help, and it's supposed to level out certain hormones, which is doing its job. But when I have to take my placebos, all of a sudden I start having, like, these last 2 months, it's made me question my recovery. It's made me question my sanity. I started having anxiety attacks again, hard time sleeping. And so my wonderful psychiatrist got me in touch with a wonderful OB because she truly believes in the hormonal component of this problem. So the OB suggested I skip the placebos and just go straight to my new pack. So for a few months, I'm going to skip my period because I guess I'm developing some type of premenstrual dysphoric disorder or something. Like, I've literally, when I have to take those placebos, I'm having, like, a postpartum relapse. It's terrible. So I'm going to skip having a period for a few months and see if that doesn't help. And apparently that's pretty common to do. And I'm thinking, there's a lot of women that go through this every month needlessly. I wonder if their doctors have even told them that this is a possibility for them, because it could save them a lot of problems.
Yeah, there's so many. Me and my sister, I think, were talking about something very much like this last week, and how there's so many women's issues, and it's like, if we just needed to get all our girlfriends together and just, like, pool all our information, because there's so many things that we suffer with needlessly, and things like the placebo pill, and this is so random, but like certain latex allergies. So some women suffer with those types of condoms, not even realizing, like, oh, I just have a latex allergy, and this information is just not given to us.
I'm on that whole Brené Brown kick, and just finished Gifts of Imperfection. And one thing that therapy has taught me is that I didn't realize how closed off of a human being I was before all this. And so I started, you know, I have a small group of friends, and we have a Facebook page. We're like kind of a play group, and some of us are closer than others. But I opened up about my postpartum mood disorder and my anxiety and a little bit of my intrusive thoughts, and I opened up, and there were some people that, like, private messaged me after that saying, I struggled with the same thing. And I'm thinking, I knew you then. Like, you literally sat in your house and struggled with this on your own. Like, that is first of all, it made me cry because I knew that I could have helped. I could have done something. But I'm tired of us as women having to go through all this quietly.
Yes.
It's just so sad to me.
I remember you told me that your mom told you that you're going to get angry about this eventually.
Yep, and I did. my therapist is awesome. She's kind of become more of a friend, and she said, "You're really mad about this therapy thing. You're really mad about it, that there are women who go and get their medication, and medication's great, and medication helps, but they'll be on medication for, like, years, and they never go to therapy." I said, "Yeah, it really bothers me that a prescription is, like, $10, but therapy with insurance is $100. It bothers me." So I've even talked to Graham a little bit about, I'm exploring this idea of starting a nonprofit to help women get therapy. And I don't even care how much money you make, because if you're going through any type of depression, whether you make six figures or not, you're not going to find yourself worth spending that money, you know. So I'm kind of exploring the idea of starting a nonprofit to help fund mothers' therapy, counseling.
Oh, that's a fantastic idea. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it is such, for me, it's such a necessity. And yet it was one for the longest time that I had to justify and, you know, joke about. And it's stupid. It's just so wonderful. It's so helpful. And still there's the stigma, and then there's the insurance not covering it.
Yeah. And some days you'll leave therapy thinking, I didn't really accomplish much. And because not every session is going to be this, like, groundbreaking. And sometimes you're going to leave therapy and go, oh, great, I'm so much more messed up than I thought. Wonderful. And then some days you'll leave therapy and feel really liberated. So it's work. It's not always fun work, but it's worth it.
Yeah, I think that mental health is actually work, that it's easier to not feel your best, to just hang out and sit on the couch and go into denial about any issues you have. But it feels so much better to just get through the work and get to the place of, it's the difference between, like, somewhat happy and actually getting to experience joy.
Exactly. Yeah. I completely agree with you on that.
Well, is there anything else we should talk about before we say goodbye to the listeners out there?
Yeah. Just one more thing. I have a few people I know that are going to be listening. I just want to say that if you are going through this and you don't feel like you can get out of the house, go to therapy or go to a support group, there are great support groups on Facebook. I'm a part of a couple of them. I have made lifelong friends on some of these pages. It's where you can just go and word vomit. And you can ask any stupid question about medication, counseling, anything. And there's a group of people that are going through what you're going through or have been through what you're going through that can answer your questions. I've used this Facebook group so many times, especially when I was going through medication adjustments and stuff like that. So find your people, find your tribe, whether it's a Facebook group or a face-to-face support group, but nobody knows what you're going through. Like my doctor, it's great that she looked at me and said, you're going to get better, but when somebody who's gone through it tells me that on a Facebook post or something, there's more weight behind it. It means more to me. Also, journal. Please journal, because it's so hard to see progress, because progress is so slow a lot of times. So there were days where I felt like I wasn't making any progress, but then I would go back on my journal, and sometimes I would not even, like, write sentences. I would just word bullet, headaches, dizziness, you know, I just list my side effects or symptoms I was having. So journaling helped me really see the progress, which helped me feel better. And if you're a person of faith, it is so hard to feel God's presence when you're in this. It really is. It takes you know, postpartum depression takes your ability to connect with anybody. Sometimes it takes your ability to connect with your baby or your friends at that point, and even God. But if you're a person of faith, it's not, you know, feelings ebb and flow. So just stick to what you know is true. He's with you, and he loves you, and he cares about your happiness, probably more than he cares about your holiness, because, I mean, let's be real. Jesus' first miracle was turning water into wine, you know. It wasn't like healing a sick person. So God cares about your happiness, too, and he cares about your family's happiness. So don't give up. Keep trying until you find what works, because you're worth it and your family's worth it.
Oh, I love that. That's just such beautiful advice. Thanks for coming on the show today, Beth.
Well, thank you for having me.
And good luck with your journey. And I have a feeling we're going to have you back on here in like another year or so.
Oh, yeah. Bring it.
Thank you, Beth, so much for reaching out and asking to share your story. I loved connecting with you. I loved hearing your story, and I'm excited to keep staying in touch with you in the future. And I know that your story will in so many ways have touched our listeners and helped moms who are struggling with the darkness right now. Beth mentioned a couple of things at the end I thought it was like that were really inspiring, talking about holiness and happiness. And she mentioned to me after the recording ended that she's reading a book, The Happiness Dare, Pursuing Your Heart's Deepest, Honest, and Most... No, I got that wrong. The Happiness Dare, Pursuing Your Heart's Deepest, Holiest, and Most Vulnerable Desire, which is written by Jennifer Dukes Lee. And she's reading it now, hasn't finished it, but it sounds really cool. And I'm going to be putting it on my Amazon wish list, possibly actually moving it straight to my Amazon cart. And I'd like to look into it. I'm not very religious these days, but that doesn't mean the Bible doesn't resonate with me. I still think Jesus was an awesome dude, and it is. And I think this actually would be a cool reading for me after 12 years, or actually technically 11 and a half years of Catholic school, to get a different read on the Bible. And she mentioned a book by Brené Brown, The Gifts of Imperfection. Love that book. And I will put links to these in the show notes, which will be at ppdadventures.com. And then she also mentioned at the very end, whew, getting out of breath on this, she mentioned that she's found her tribe a lot on Facebook. And so for those of you who are looking for a Facebook tribe, I suggest a couple places to start are Graham's Self-Care Squad. Graham was on the show a couple episodes ago. And there's also now the Postpartum Collective, which is a place for everyone. And it's a place for advocates and professionals and sufferers. And it's a great place to get started on finding resources. So I will put links to those places in the show notes for you, as well as all the other crazy things I mentioned in the intro about like Richard Simmons. Okay, so postpartum depression is an incredibly lonely and isolating illness, but you can and will make a full recovery. You did nothing wrong. You did nothing to deserve this. And you are not alone. I love you, and I hope you have a wonderful week.